In fact, Priestley was already on record as preferring the, quote, writer of romances to the faithful historian. The historian, he declared in his lectures on oratory and criticism, can engage only the disposition of events, whereas the romancier can at least hope to gain some access to the springs of the human passions. Priestley professed himself an admirer of Clarissa, George Barnwell, Eloise, and any other well-contrived fictions, making no important distinction among what to us look like hard and fast generic lines, novel, drama, poem. But to open access to otherwise hidden springs, romance did have to make its own superficiality and fictionality, its own disposition, its composition, apparent, as history did not. It did so through a kind of effervescent spring. The thought of its being a fiction enables us to make but a feeble and ineffectual effort to repress our feelings, Priestley observed, and those who have acquired an aversion to all works of fiction are incapable of the unprejudiced attention which this experiment requires. Thus Priestley the literary theorist. He kept company with Priestley the grammarian, whose rudiments of English grammar held that a grammar may be compared to a treatise of natural philosophy, the one consisting of observation on the various changes, combinations, and mutual affections of words, and the other on those of the parts of nature. Priestley the pneumatic chemist, meanwhile, presumed that air was the most recombinant of all parts of nature, and he was asking his reader to experiment with him imaginatively upon the factitious airs themselves, and thereby virtually to enter the contingent and composite forms that they assumed at any given moment and in any given place. Priestley's open, friendly style guaranteed just about any English reader admission to the exuberantly superficial world that these forms composed. All that reader needed to be able to do was accept the ever-shifting alliances of differing forms or kinds as the precondition of what we experience and agree to call the surrounding uniformity of common air. To its reader, Experiments and Observations therefore submits a vivid, eventful, and often extremely beautiful hologram of the factitious airs, one that does nothing if not toy with the slinky of the unprejudiced attention. In one experiment, some delicate flowers are suspended within the region of fixed air over fermenting vats. Later, contact with two different kinds of air gives rise to a beautiful white cloud. Nor was the delight that Priestley took in his airs only that of the involved spectator. Drawing vital air, or pure oxygen, through a glass siphon, he reported, I fancied my head felt peculiarly easy and light for some time afterward. That fizzy water, it was so delicious he thought he might go ahead and distribute it on the open market. Watching bubbles form, rise, and froth in a basin of brew, he declares he has met with few persons who are soon weary of looking at it. Indeed, some could sit by it a whole hour and be agreeably amused all the time. Having crystallized nitrous air in a vial, the chemist returns to find the container almost filled with the most beautiful crystallizations imaginable, and his pen renders the feathery form they take in the airiest, most delicate of strokes. A more beautiful appearance can hardly be imagined, he rhapsodizes, and I am afraid I shall never see the like again. That's why I love Priestley. Sublimely fanciful they may be, but such experiments also give rise to unanticipated effects, fear, as here, or even a heightened moral sense. Priestley's nitrous feathers seem to decay, reduced to one compact mass without anything of the beautiful appearance they had made before. The chemist hurries to repair the injury. Ever on the lookout for an air of superior goodness, he is fascinated by the fact that though oxygen, vital air, is the reason whatever it is we breathe gives life, we cannot thrive unless that air be adulterated. We might, as may be said, live out too fast, and the animal powers be too soon exhausted in this pure kind of air, Priestley mused. A moralist, at least, may say that the air which nature has provided for us is as good as we deserve. Though Priestley could not pretend to be this moralist, he could at least take on the air of one, nurtured by the freedom created by what may be said and by what a certain kind of philosopher may say. Such fictional equivocations free the language of air to synthesize immaterial and material versions of reality, revealing unforeseen analogies, real points of transference between them. This was possible because, in Priestley's book, not only is nothing air, it's just a word that refers to something that is always changing as different kinds of air make and remake it. Not only is nothing air, but everything is air. With respect to the aerial form of substances, the chemist, unfixing everything indeed, found that there is no substance in nature but what is capable of assuming that form. It's not fizzy. Now, why couldn't the matter of Priestley's own writing count as one of such intrinsically formal substance? Oh, but it could. Or at least it was partly by finding and arranging on the page proper terms by which to distinguish them that Priestley saw himself to have given rise to this new sense of common air. I have been under a necessity of giving names to those kinds of air to which no names have been given by others, he wrote, even as he assured his readers that no person was ever more temperate or more cautious than I have been in the introduction of new terms, and that it was with great hesitation, but compelled by necessity, that I did it at all, and always adopting such as were analogous to others in established use. Priestley's liberty of expression was obviously bound up with that of the air he expressed. But in both cases, liberty depends on what would seem to inhibit it, repetition, hesitation, and the pressure of necessity. In verbal terms, Priestley further limited himself by using the term air as expressive of the mere form in which a substance is exhibited, without any consideration of the elements in which it consists. But the limits of his formalism opened deep springs of freedom. Just consider the names of Priestley's many heirs. Like any character in modern fiction, each possessed a first and a last, though the surname, heir, was always and everywhere the same. So, in experiments and observations, we meet not nitrogen or carbon dioxide or even sulfur, but mephitic air, fixed air, vital air, dephlogisticated air, nitrous air. Priestley's heirs hover somewhere between adjectives and nouns, place markers and thing markers. If anything, his aim appears to have been to keep air up in the air. Those who choose to apply air to a substance and not to a form are certainly at full liberty to do so if they please, he reassures, and provided we understand one another, no inconvenience will result from our use of a different language. As forms that might or might not count as substances, the different kinds of air virtually embody principles of diversity, universality, commonality, and infinite possibility. As for the verbs that Priestley selected to register their manners and behaviors, these plainly showed their relationship to the often fanciful observer and were very often explicitly figurative. Priestley's heirs were imbibed or themselves impregnated. They became depraved, got injured, or infected. They were diminished, vitiated. Once in a while, they even proved their goodness. In the candid and free-form naming of the heirs, we can't help but detect Priestley's own limitations. His alienation from natural philosophies rapidly consolidating increasingly abstract discursive conventions, for example. It stands to reason he grew up in Yorkshire, of all places, received no elite education to speak of, taught English lit and language in a dissenting academy, very far from either Oxford or Cambridge. Priestley pursued his experiments in out-of-the-way places like Birmingham and Bath, and ultimately took his vials and retorts to the far-flung skirts of the Susquehanna. But there's something else in his self-consciously literary grammar of atmosphere that his self-consciously literary grammar of atmosphere aimed at, avoidance of the air itself. I mean this literally because it happens that Priestley spoke with a terrible stutter. Terrible is almost exactly how he described it in his memoirs, which return obsessively to, quote, the impediment in my speech, which I inherited and which still attends me. Sometimes I absolutely stammered, he recalled, and my anxiety about it was the cause of much distress to me. Indeed, the impediment in his speech evoked, quote, such distress of mind as it is not in my power to describe, and which I still look back upon with horror. Priestley, it appears, was actually scared of her. He didn't want to talk about it because that meant he would have to talk with it. But this was the lot of all people. Priestley's rudiments of English grammar had remarked that by means of its elasticity, air affords to all animals that live in it a most convenient medium of communication by sounds. But human communication always stumbles, for it consists chiefly in checking and stopping the air in a great variety of ways. Speakers of the principal northern tongues, like English, made matters worse because they did not give the air a free passage out of their mouths, but made great use of their tongues and lips in retarding and modulating it. Priestley's own difficulties here were obviously and literally compounded, as he had inherited such an unreliable instrument for forming the air into intelligible shape. Seeking some replacement for that instrument, he found it in writing. Early on, Priestley's indescribably horrifying defect of speech spurred attachment to the written word as a form of regulation and compensation, as a shelter even. It became his childhood custom to recollect as much as I could of the sermons I heard and to commit it to writing. Writing at home almost as much as I had heard, I insensibly acquired a habit of composing with great readiness. In adulthood, literary composition remained both a form of material management and a protective amelioration of troubled utterance.